Well, you, since you have your own YouTube channel, do you have kind of a bio video at all on your YouTube channel saying anything about who you are, Matt? Should I call you Matt or Matthew? Which would you prefer?
Matthew.
Matthew. Okay.
No, I'm still in the process of my autobiography, and I put to side autobiography because I don't know what that means. And I'm not trying to sound pretentious when I say that. I don't make the videos to talk about myself. I'm very much philosophically bent. So the videos constituted trying to unbend and make straight thinking, or at least my own.
But now you visited an Orthodox church recently. I watched that video. Did you grow up going to church?
Yes, extensively. I was brought up Lutheran.
Oh,
and
okay.
And so I have Protestant conviction running through my veins. Mm-hmm. And that over time got, there were doses of steroids put in when I went to college and found a very rigid and rigorous TULIP following Baptist denomination. And TULIP obviously is code word for a certain persuasions of the extent of God's sovereignty, as you know, and
right.
Things of this nature. And then quickly, I left that, became an atheist. In meme terms, I became a doomer for about 4 years in a place called Lincoln, Nebraska.
A doomer? Then, what's a doomer?
Oh, well, it's a meme. So on the internet, there's a kind of trinity that is used to explain anthropology, like how people get through their 20s. And it's secular, but it has its roots in 4chan and things like this, things which I don't take part of, but I know where it comes from because I have friends that did it. Anyway, short in brief, this is the trinity. You start as a Wojak, right? You're just a blank tabula rasa. You are what you are. You're some fusion of nature and nurture. And then as you age and progress, your development looks like this. You get disenchanted with the world and with systems and everything you're brought up with. And that disenchantment is seen as a darkness and a giving up of hope. It's like Neo waking up in that little pink pod in the movie The Matrix, but not having an Ebenezer or a Nebuchadnezzar to find him. No friends. After he's been red-pilled, he just wakes up in the pod.
Without Morpheus.
Without Morpheus, and he has to climb down that tower himself. And so what they do in this meme lore is they go to 7-Elevens, they get cigarettes, they get beer, they go in front of a computer at night in a huge apartment complex that there are no numbers for, there are no people with relationships in, and you just live out your existence earning a wage. Then you get beyond that, if you're lucky, to become what's called a bloomer, where you see the other side of the coin, the stone has been pushed out of the way, and you are resurrected into a fully integrated Jungian archetype of the sword sheath. Now, all of that is interesting, but to me, it's paper thin because it doesn't have, to use one of your words in the last video I saw, an ontology enervating it. It is simply folklore, internet folklore. That's all it is. But it borrows from, and I don't want to sound pretentious, but it doesn't give credence to its ontological presuppositions. But it's not enough to say, because I'm not a presuppositionalist, that it should give credence to those things. Because if someone bends their knees, their heart might not be soft. And Paul talks time and again about illuminating the eyes of your heart. And I have no idea how to convey that to someone who isn't already convinced. So there's an inherent paradox in Christian apologetics that I think we're starting to feel and see. Mm-hmm. But there is no way to re-energize what happened in the latter part of the 20th century by just putting some really smart people out there to regurgitate or reinvigorate arguments from first causes. That's not going to do it anymore. People hear it and then they say, well, that's great. I like conversation. But what's next? What's deeper? And it comes to a faith statement, but that is so difficult to articulate without doing it in bad faith.
And what I want to hear your thoughts on that. Doing it in bad faith? You mean, is that what Peterson is talking about when he dares not say he believes in God?
You know what? I think so. Would you elaborate where you're coming from with that?
Well, some of this stuff that you've, this internet folklore that you just laid out, this is fascinating. I've never heard any of this. Being an old guy that myself who knows how to use the internet, but I'm not really familiar with 4chan or the dark web or any of that. I do have a, I just did another conversation with Jem, who I talked about, well, I talked with, posted a video with him a few weeks ago, and he's very much in the same place as Peterson in terms of, he dare not say he believes in God. And so what we did in the conversation with him yesterday was we kind of dug into a little bit this question of belief. And in reading this this book on Erasmus and Luther lately, one of the things that I've been thinking about is how psychological faith became with this transition that happened with Luther. And I think part of what, you know, Luther and the Protestant Reformation was kind of a turning point. It was really the beginning of modernism, and now we're at another turning point, and many people, by no means all, because many other people don't have difficulty feeling faith or experiencing faith psychologically, but for those who, for whatever reason, don't or can't feel faith psychologically, what does discipleship then look like moving forward? And I think in some ways it looks like acting as if they believe, because I think when Peterson says he doesn't believe, he's talking about a psychological state. So
acting, can I get in?
Yeah, go ahead.
Can I jump in real quick? Because I know we only have 30 minutes, so I definitely want this to be a repartee back and forth.
Yep.
So this morning it kept coming into my mind that I wanted to bring forth to us, and this will tie into what you just said in terms of psychologizing fidelity, because again, he asks for the eyes of our heart. He doesn't ask for motor movement and locomotion and everything that got drilled into American consciousness with the Protestant work ethic, which I really do see as a working out of the U in TULIP of unconditional election. That was a horrible, in my opinion, fissure of what it means to walk with God, because it gave up, it became agnostic to the idea that you can know what you are. And when you give that up, all you have left is what you do with your day. And so the idea of you will know them by their fruits gets plucked out of the context of false teaching and put in the soil of what it means to be in relationship with God. How can you know you're there? Well, you know you don't know you're there because you don't know what you are. All you can do is say a little prayer and do a lot of actions. And it just so happened that capitalism came around that. And so that is a nice magnification lens of action over being. And anytime we want to talk about being, because we're so enmeshed and entangled in capitalistic presuppositions, that just seems like socialism and communitarianism and surveillance and no work, no effort, laying around. Politically, people are talking about the Freedom Dividend by Andrew Yang, and they're saying, well, here's a true blue blood Democrat. He just wants to give people $1,000 a month so they can be more human. And of course, I'm characterizing this.
Right.
But I hear in that the whisper of, you're meant to work. And people even take the Garden of Eden and say, well, we were, before the fall, meant to work. But I do think if we're not careful, we rely on a kind of work ethic that isn't native to the ontology that Christ gives. Because I'll admit, I put my cards on the table. I'm one of those people, I believe in the resurrection. Like, I believe that all the work, the significant work, has been done. And so now, and to your point of discipleship, it's about exposing the mystery. It's about the mysterium tremendum. It's about taking the shoes off in front of the fire and experiencing and growing and really having a sense of no guilt. Now, obviously, there's virtue involved, education, coming out of the dark. There's work to be done. But it really has to do a turn pre-modernity. And I don't think post-modernity and being ironic and going beyond is going to help us. Søren Kierkegaard, my favorite saint, said, looking back at the Greeks, trying to be Christian post-Luther, he looked at the Greeks and he said, now remember Heraclitus, that great philosopher. He said you couldn't step into the same river twice. His disciples thought they were doing Heraclitus a favor by going beyond him and said, no, you can't even step into the same, you can't even step into a river. let alone step into it twice. And he said that was that constituted their foolishness and not understanding the master's teaching. And ironically, instead of going ahead of him and furthering his theory, they degraded it into a kind of decadence. And I think that movement can also be had with Christ and his disciples. And I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm just sharing with you and I want to hear your thoughts back, where we can almost take, we can do that move with Heraclitus. Now, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, the open the eyes of our heart. This, if memory serves me, is a prayer that Paul prays at the beginning of the book of Ephesians. And it's not, in the book of Ephesians, the nature of the prayer that it was a request by the Apostle Paul is that this is a request made of God, that God would do this for us. I think your contrast between working and being is one that has a long history in the church with respect to our telos, because there tends to be, you know, Dante in the Paradiso has the beatific vision. So, and that's in contrast to much more of a Calvinist strain, you're right, where the end is kind of a return to the garden. And I remember the first job I ever had was cleaning a bakery, and it was an old Dutch Christian Reformed baker that was in his last years, and I started my job. And the first day at work, he started in on a theological discussion with me, and he said, yeah, work is part of the fall. And I said, I was 16. I said, no, work is, I had Reformed catechesis. I said, work is part of the cultural mandate. Be fruitful and multiply and fulfill the earth.
Very well. Yes.
So, you know, that tension in terms of our, you know, what our final destination is it the beatific vision, or is it this fruitful stewardship now, the pre-lapsarian Adam unencumbered by sin, now obviously in New Jerusalem, and let's say further up and further in, and the work issue gets involved with meaning too, because there's something deeply connected between work and meaning, if it's meaningful work where you're not just moving sand across a concentration.
Let me ask you this. So I'm working through orthodoxy, and I don't want to be, I tend to be an enthusiast.
Big O or little O orthodoxy? Big O is Orthodox Church. Little O is just Christian orthodoxy. Although in the Orthodox Church, they wouldn't have that distinction. But as a Protestant, you say you're looking into orthodoxy in terms of the Orthodox Church, or are you looking into orthodoxy general within Christianity?
I don't want to not be where the sheep, Christ's sheep are. So I want to say little o.
Okay.
But right now I find myself physically, finitely in capital O. And I'm an enthusiast. Like, I go up and in. So I'm even contemplating like the monk's life. And because I've always been about these theological matters, but I know I also just like philosophy, and I know I'm a believer in these things, but I don't want to move prematurely. In other words, I want to discern the call. So that's what I'm working through in those two senses. So it is a both and, not an either or. But in terms of the capital O, so I've been to two services, and they were paradigm crashing for me, like a chandelier falling to the ground, because I was used to Lutheran services, Baptist services, hour-long sermons. This sermon was 15 minutes and then an hour's worth of chanting and looking at icons. And then this last time, bless her heart, one of the ladies who welcomed me said I could burn a candle in front of an icon.
Interesting.
10,000 questions come to my mind. And then I just say out of nowhere, that picture over there looks quite good. I kind of feel the words kind of jump out of my mouth sometimes. I said, I feel like a synchronicity with it. Thinking of Jung and of these other people. I just say these things. I don't really, I don't mean anything necessarily by them. But she's like, oh, that one, that's John Chrysostom. He's kind of a big heavyweight. And I'm like, maybe I'll burn a candle at him next time. So I looked at the icon which had Mary depicted, and I said, give me time, give me time. Because there was this deep sense of reverie and veneration that I haven't felt before. And I don't know if that is mere difference talking, because there were no guitars playing, there was no speaker system. So I don't know if it's the mere difference and honeymoon phase, or if it's emblematic of something that is being shipped over from the Atlantic and is beginning to emerge finally from the soil. Because Orthodoxy Capillo has been spread across the United States for quite some time. Yeah. And I don't want to confuse my personal idiosyncrasies with larger structures, but I wonder if people are talking about Russia for a reason. I wonder if Eastern Orthodoxy is making that emergence for a reason in the capital C church. What do you think?
Oh, I very much think so. As I, you know, as I'm thinking about these big movements, about moving now past a very psychological faith, faith has gotten so psychological. People want something that they can see and touch and taste. And so I very much think that we're going to, and it's been around for a long time, see much more of a sacramentalist approach to a neo-sacramentalism. And so it makes complete sense to me that there's a tremendous amount of interest in, see, Roman Catholicism has been around in the States for a long time, and in a sense, it's been tarnished by the pedophile priest scandal. Orthodoxy is brand new, okay? And so I completely understand the newfound interest in it. The question will be, how enduring will that interest be? Because if there's anything true about the Orthodox faith, they are a patient tribe. And you know, they are not
the resurrection, Paul. I think part of it is the resurrection. Like, they sincerely, I'm not speaking broadly, but in my own heart, we sincerely believe in the resurrection. So we have an infinite patience.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting to see how that matches up with American ADHD.
Precisely, in this materialism. And
lack of attention span.
In this materialism, it goes back to that work ethic. We have it backwards. Like, we associate things with being. And we forget that we cannot relate to the world. We relate to God. Like, the pastor doesn't face us in service. He faces the icons, yeah. Which sounds like blasphemy. He faces icons and venerates them. People kiss pictures there. People kiss the book. I was a novelist. But the moment I saw a woman kiss the golden book after we read Mark, I was like Thomas Aquinas, and everything I had written and all my dreams of publication burned away like straw. And again, I'm not trying to sound like an idealist. That's just the reality. I thought the book's already been written. What I was doing with those books and with narrative in general was trying to anticipate this joy. Now, I say that not from a psychological perspective. Nobody sat me down and articulated a formula that would allow me to say that, right. Confess that to you. I just saw it. And when you look at it, it's kind of a silly thing to look at. A person kissed a book. Big deal. You see, you can go to a play in Broadway and see that. But it wasn't the same.
Right.
And Soren Kierkegaard talked about the virtue of the absurd. So he gave this great, I know you watched that video that I made about existentialism. And I think a great gateway drug to this eternal patience, call it capital O or lowercase o orthodoxy, that eternal patience, the gateway drug to that, I think, is Kierkegaardian existentialism, not Jean-Paul Sartre's existentialism of bad faith, where let's look at the waiters, let's look at the blue-collar workers of the world and see how they are eternally struggling with the forces of capitalism or whatever class struggle you want to put it in. Kierkegaard, he was an aristocrat, I grant you that. But he was a deep intellectual. He saw that chivalry was an outgrowth of the eternal patience. Because here's the premise, and I'll be quick with this because I want your thoughts. In his book, my favorite book, I call him Saint Kierkegaard now because I think he's up there with the saints. He hasn't been recognized as such, but I think he was doing martyr work back then. Because similar in Copenhagen, they were asking themselves, what does it mean to be a Christian? Is it the cultural mandate? Or is it you don't read newspapers? Because journalism was just starting. And they were deciding what populace was, what the mass audience was. And Kierkegaard thought that was a sin, because no people are in the mass. He used it ironically, of course. He knew his Catholicism. He said, there is no...
He was Lutheran. Mass. I mean, this is Denmark.
Precisely. And Kierkegaard, unlike Luther, never came down from the Dark Tower, I would argue.
That's interesting. Kierkegaard was a strange man.
Oh.
A very strange man. And his life was, you know, I read a biography that came out 3-4 years ago. Fascinating guy. It's going to be interesting. Yeah. The advent of the Orthodox Church in America will be, I'm going to be interested in watching how that plays out. And especially with, there's a few people that I know via the meetups here in Northern California who've been involved with the Orthodox Church. And I'm just curious about long-term how it's going to go. I'm just curious. And that isn't to say, I'm just curious because I don't know.
I'm curious too, Paul. My proclivity is individualism, partly because I'm an only child. I don't know how green the grass is on the other side, but part of it is, I think, the Americanism of do your own thing, you're a free individual. And then also, Kierkegaard found me. I don't mean to sound romantic about this, but it was 12 o'clock in the morning at the library at South Dakota State University. I was supposed to be studying mathematics because I thought I was going to be a theoretical physicist. And I walked upstairs. I walked by, because I was used to walking alone among bookshelves. I've always loved to read. I was walking there. The place was about to shut down. I knew all the janitors because I stayed late. I never read what I was supposed to. I just read randomly. And then for some reason, I went to the philosophy section. I bent a knee and picked out this old yellow leaf book that had been checked out last time in 1962. And it was Fear and Trembling.
Oh, yeah.
And I had never been gripped by an author before. And I thought, could this be, and this was just when Tulip was getting planted in me. I had a girlfriend. We were both thinking about how to teach our kids Tulip. Total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace. Well, Kierkegaard was irresistible to me. Like, I heard this translated English of his eccentricities. But at any rate, he talked about those two knights. So he took the chivalry idea. You have an individual, and this goes to your point of what will orthodoxy look like in 50 years? Take your typical orthodox, give them a coat of arms. Call that coat of arms the current cultural milieu. Ohio, Iowa, Alaska, Florida, doesn't matter. That's their coat of arms. You don't see their face. They don't have faces like C.S. Lewis, till we have faces. You just see all their commitments, their vows, their prognostications. You put two up against one another. You know that movie Timeline? A Knight's Tale? Where they, okay, all about
oh,
it is.
That, yeah, I think I watched Knight's Tale years ago.
Yeah, where they have the thing on their arm and they're on the horses and they have to run at one another.
Or they're jousting.
Jousting, thank you. So imagine two knights in jousts. They're both under Christendom. The one knight is the knight of infinite resignation and the other is the knight of faith, according to Kierkegaard's conceptualization. They both have the Christian milieu. They might have different Christian milieus. They both agree in the propositions of the church. What differentiates them? Who will win? Kierkegaard, he was always writing pseudonymously. He thought he didn't have faith. He had a God that for him was lyrical. He was a feeling God. Whenever someone in the world brought him down, he could pray to this good feeling. That was cultural appropriation of theology. That constituted the night of infinite resignation. God was an antidote to chaos. He wasn't the God of Isaac, Abraham, the God who fulfills promises. The night of faith, you take off his armor, he looks bourgeoisie, according to Kierkegaard. Does all the normal stuff, nothing exceptional about him. Not, and I love this line from Kierkegaard, not a little note of light shining through that armor of eccentricity and idiosyncrasy and weirdness. It's all plain. But in himself is that faith of Abraham that says, even though there's a divorce, even though I'm bankrupt, God will restore it. And he smiles without quivering. How can he do that? It's absurd. It's literally unspeakable. Mm-hmm. Kierkegaard thought that was authentic religion. And the only kind of religion that would make unique the Christian confession, as opposed to all the other religions that can double as a metaphysic. Christianity for Kierkegaard wasn't ornate metaphysics. It was that thing you can't see in two knights who vow that they love the same woman the same way under the same conditions. What are your thoughts? I know I just said things that I think you and I both agree. Well, actually, I don't know. I just want to hear.
Well, I don't know. I'm trying to remember. If I read Fear and Trembling, it was a lot of years ago. And I've spoke about it recently with Dr. Jim from Idaho. And that was quite interesting getting into it. But I don't really feel like I can comment on what you just laid out.
That's fine. I'm a zealot. I'm an enthusiast for these things. Whatever you want to say.
Well, you should take some time on your channel to go through Fear and Trembling. I think that would be a good exercise. And okay. part of what I think helps people with channels, the woman that's reading Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, can never remember.
Yeah.
Channel. Yeah. I think that's a good way that's a good thing to do with a channel, because you really have a focus, and unlike my ADHD channel where I'm all over the place, you really have a focus and you can really dig into something and create a community around a body of work. But what happened today was weird, because everybody signed up for half-hour slots. I think somebody started it, and then everybody just had these little half-hour slots. I usually have an hour, and I wish I had an hour to talk to you, but I don't. And so the next guy's coming in a minute. So
I get you.
But anyway, thanks for coming on. Keep making videos, and I'll send this one to you.
Thanks. Bye, Paul. Okay, bye.